I continue to this very day to be John Atack thus far, and this is my dear friend, actually, Dr. Stephen Moffat. Hi, Steve.
Hi, John. How are you, everybody?
And let's just start with an homage to the total eclipse, because you witnessed the total eclipse. So tell us a little bit of the wow factor about that.
Yeah, it was, you know, one of the great experiences people can have in life, but hard to get to and see, you know. So we went to Texas to see the solar eclipse in its totality. Supposed to be the most likely sunny area of the country, as it turned out. There's this saying, man plans and God winks. And lo and behold, it was pretty cloudy. And so the eclipse had a sort of struggle to actually take place. So we saw tidbits on and off, but that was enough. And what is part of it that makes it so great is it's kind of a collective positive experience. I think the emotions are positive, that there's this awe and respect for nature that occurs, which is, I think, a good thing, especially in a time when we're destroying some of nature and the climate instability is going on. So I think it was especially timely. So anybody who ever has a chance, I think, to see a total eclipse, because they obviously occur all over the world, maybe once every 2 years or so over land, take the chance and see it. It's an awe feeling of awe is good for you. The more feelings of awe you get, especially for positive things, because there could be awe for negative things too, but the more you get them from positive things, the better.
My friend and colleague Yuval Lahor, who has, yeah, with the name Lahor, he's been, of course, studying awe all of these years. And I tried to point out to him that something can be awful or it can be awesome. But he didn't like these words.
No, and sometimes combined. Sometimes you
absolutely
get, you know, a positive feeling, but also a feeling of unease because of, in a way, how emotionally powerful it is. So, yeah, it's not a foolproof positive thing.
No, and Spike was, I sent you the lovely little piece that she wrote about her experience, and she was sort of wondering how, you know, medieval peasants will have felt about this. But she admits that she had to grab hold of her husband's hand because of the sense of fear and apprehension that you can also feel when something changes so suddenly.
Yeah, you know, when we don't know the science behind things and can't predict things, something like the eclipse must have been terrifying, you know, in the past, and naturally terrifying. You know, now we can predict it exactly when it's going to happen. And I think that definitely reduces the fear involved with it. But still, just the feeling of awe has a tinge of fear because of how powerful the experience is.
And I couldn't agree more. And I'm sure Yuval would agree that awe experiences are useful for us. They lift us out of ourselves and help us to see from a different perspective. And I think often we kind of just caught in the tram lines of our routine. And so something that, you know, a great movie or a wonderful piece of music or a majestic event is what we need. I'm going to go and see Michael Tilson Thomas conducting the London Symphony Orchestra in Mahler's Third Symphony next month. And I'm looking forward to some awe there. I'm also this month at the Albert Hall to see the Dave Matthews Band, and which will be a real treat because they so rarely play here, you know.
Right. And yeah, what you said is so important because you're sort of seeking out the possibilities, because if you don't think about the potential and just take experiences for granted, experiences that might be awesome aren't, because you're really not paying attention to them. And with Michael Tilson Thomas, besides the music and besides it being a great conductor, it's just amazing that he's doing this because he has brain cancer. And, not long to live, apparently. So it's just extraordinary that he wants to keep giving his gift of music, ability, and love to the rest of us in this terribly difficult medical situation.
Absolutely. I didn't realize that. That is, is quite astounding. And yeah. Bless him. Bless him for wanting to give me pleasure still.
Yes.
Definitely a good thing.
Exactly.
I sent you over their extracts from this book here. And let me preface this a little by saying that in May 1950, on the 9th of May 1950, Elrin Hubbard's Dianetics, The Modern Science of Mental Health was published. Now, he figured he was going to make a lot of money from it. He'd already, a year before, written to his literary agent and said that he'd found a method where you could rape women and they would have no knowledge of it, and from which he intended to make a great deal of money. Didn't say anything in the letter about any benefit to anybody. The method, when it came out, I was in correspondence with one of the three people who were with him during the months that he was writing the book, a guy called Don Rogers. And in fact, for many years into the 1980s, there was an appendix of the book written by Don Rogers, The Schematic of the Mind or something like that. And so Don was very close in, and he said that when the commission came through for Hubbard to write the book, Hubbard turned to him and said, I'm going to have to change the method because deep trance hypnotism is not popular. So what research he'd done had been done using deep trance hypnotism, and he moved over into what's called the reverie method. Now, Scientologists defend the use of this word reverie, but it is absolutely the standard word that was used in 1950 for what is some people call a light hypnotic trance, which is to say, a state of consciousness in which you can be controlled from the outside, but appear to be awake, you know, fully in control of your faculties. So the method itself, and I did a lot of research on this, as people watching this channel will probably know, was developed by Josef Breuer, who was Sigmund Freud's mentor. He lent Freud a great deal of money over the years. And Freud marks this as the beginning of Freudian analysis, when this technique was used on Anna von O, as she's called in the literature. And the end of the therapy, in fact, was not quite what Freud pronounced to the world. The end of the therapy was that Anna von O was admitted to an asylum for morphine addiction by Josef Breuer. He signed the intake forms, and Breuer had actually prescribed to the morphine to which she'd become addicted. So not quite the huge success that was publicized later. In 1911, I think it was, Freud gave a series of lectures at Worcester, Massachusetts, which we'll put a link to those. And in one of those lectures, he describes the Dianetic method. I was flabbergasted when I read this, having left Scientology. It's got counting backwards to get the person there, you know, into a state of reverie, accepting state. It has the idea of emotional charge, and the word charge is used in the translation, which Hubbard would make a great thing of. Of course, the Freudian method is kind of hydraulic. It's like, if you push here, then something will have to come out here. And so you have repression and all of this. We now know that the human mind is not steam driven. So the hydraulic aspect of this comparison isn't necessarily good. But Freud re-examined the method and said, actually, we can't use this method because it doesn't resolve the transference. It doesn't mean that you'll come out of the session able to deal with authority figures better in your life. In fact, he said, it increases dependency. And that would explain quite a lot. The method was very successful. The book sold 150,000 copies by October 1950. It was a craze. It was all over the place. And then the publisher withdrew it. It was a medical publisher and called Artsepos Hermitage House. And he withdrew it because he said it was fraudulent, that it didn't in fact work, that their research cases, 273 research cases were claimed, there'd been no such research. And Hubbard ceased to be popular. He would not be popular again until the 1960s. So he struggled along with a few hundred followers through the 50s and 60s. But in 1951, just a year after publishing Dianetics, The Modern Science of Mental Health, Hubbard published a book called Science of Survival. And in this book, he banned the original Dianetic method because he said it's hypnotic. So, for example, you'll see a fluttering of the eyelids as the person enters reverie. And he says this is a clear indication of hypnotism or a state of hypnosis. However, despite having banned it because it's hypnotic, his own words, he then reintroduced it in 1977, and it persists to this day. It's still being used. So that brings us to the method itself. I don't know how you'd like to approach this. Do you want me to read out a little bit of it and make commentary, or would you just want to make a general assessment having read it?
Well, I'll just give you my general reaction after
your 2 cents.
I read it without going into details. Mm-hmm. I mean, your reference to Freud and the similarity between what he wrote about it and this process is striking. And so, and I think historically, you know much more than me about the whole development, really on both sides, Freud and the Scientology side. But it struck me as I hate to use this word, but a brilliant bastardization of psychoanalysis, behavioral modification, and hypnosis, kind of all thrown together. You know, it reminded me of how something discovered, like atomic energy or whatever, can have the potential for bad or good, depending on how it's used. So, I think he grabbed hold of some of the essence of these therapeutic processes, but didn't use them to help people become freer in their minds, to the contrary. So reminded me a little bit too of the popular movie Star Wars. You know, you have this force that's portrayed outside, this powerful force. And if you tap into it, you could tap into it for good or for bad. And and so I think this struck me as something like that. And because it had, you know, therapeutic potential elements in it, I could see where it also might seem attractive to people or practically usable. So so I had very mixed feelings about it. Some admiration, which I wish I didn't have, but also that how it was used was destructive for people. So
And I think that's very important, that, you know, I'm taken to be a, you know, a critic of Scientology. I am that's fair to say, but that then gives people the notion that I'm, you know, whatever it is, I'm against it, in the words of Groucho. And it isn't my perspective that people who do Scientology are gullible and benefit in no way from what happens. I think the engagement is often useful for people at some times. The problem is that, as the Inuits say, so I'm told, gifts make slaves. And sometimes that feeling of liberation that can come about during these procedures is then used to trap you into paying more money and becoming ever more dependent. So rather than, you know, the original promise in 1950, and this construction does become interesting. Hubbard posited the idea that you have an analytical mind and a reactive mind. These two minds live together. Now, these would previously have, among hypnotists, been known as the conscious mind and the hypnotic mind. Now, Freud and others would use the term unconscious. And let's point out, for the sake of history, that the idea of an unconscious mind predates Freud. It was well established in the 1840s. So by the time he's born, there is already this idea. And there's a competing set of ideas from Pierre Janet. And both Freud and Janet studied with Charcot in the Salpêtrière Institute in Paris. And Charcot was one of the great innovators of hypnotism. And the ideas that Janet devised at that time fell out of use and are much closer to the way we think about the mind now. you know, the Freudian model of the superego, the internal policeman, the ego or self, and the id, the little monster inside that has all of our lusts and what have you. They haven't found them. They've been exploring to find these three elements of the human being in the brain, but they don't appear to exist. But I've known people who benefited tremendously from having this process or a similar process, and then became entrapped. So, you know, there were all sorts of ridiculous claims made for this technique. You were going to have, you know, a tremendous intelligence. You were going to have absolute emotional equilibrium. You would never catch a cold again. But you'd be proofed against viruses. That isn't in fact true. You know, I have personal experience of that and have talked with about 1,000 people who've been involved with Scientology. So, but you then start, then the cures started getting stronger. Your short-sightedness would go. Hubbard was short-sighted to the end of his days, wore glasses to the end of his days. Your asthma would go. Hubbard had asthma until his dying day. He also smoked cigarettes until 4 years before he died. He smoked 80 cigarettes a day, which he'd cut down from 100 a day.
Mm.
This is the founder of a drug rehabilitation group. It's like, okay, we can cure addiction, but not that addiction, you know.
Yeah. And you could use hypnosis to help, you know, nicotine addiction. So again, there's this little element of truth in it.
Yeah, and it's very interesting that, you know, he actually used self-hypnotic affirmations in the 1940s, and they leaked through a court case in 1984 in Los Angeles. And they're called the affirmations, these things. And he tells himself things like, you have perfect and lovely feet. And he also is psyching himself up for an examination by the Veterans Administration where he's seeking a pension. And there's a little affirmation where he says, you know, as soon as the examination is over, you'll feel fine again. It's like, you won't be blind and crippled and all of this stuff. So he's a man who's deeply immersed in the use of hypnotism. He elsewhere claims that he started learning hypnotism at the age of 16, which would be somewhere around 1927, 28. And in his book, Science of Survival in 51, where he cancels the Dianetic method as hypnotic, he also says, never believe a hypnotist. And I think in this case, that's good advice, you know, that he is leading you on to somewhere else. And this idea, the claims of cure then go to, we can cure cancer, we can cure leukemia, we can raise people from the dead. These are actual printed claims of Scientology, which by having a kind of cloak of religion is able to get away with these medical claims. And I have to say that sadly, the rate of death from cancer among Scientologists is higher than that in the general public, because they don't seek treatment early enough. They think they have magical abilities.
Right.
Yeah,
you just mentioned religions too, and I think obviously Scientology has posed itself as a religion. But again, there's this kernel of truth, because you get in the fringes of fundamentalist religions of any sort, and you see some of the same sort of thought control being done, not in the same way, perhaps, but it's similar in what it does to people. And yes, people who are fundamentalists in a religious sense, it could be doing some good for them, gives them a community, gives them a sense of security, and so on, but also controls them. And and so the overlap sometimes of religions and cults are difficult to parse. And I think in general, we have to watch out for control of the mind. It's also interesting to me historically that the early 1950s, at least in the United States, was a time that brainwashing was really looked into and used. The great psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton started to do his research on brainwashing. He focused on China. But the CIA in the United States, and I think it was 1953, and recently someone named Stephen Kinzer, I think, wrote a book about the whole CIA process and all the different methods that were used to see if brainwashing could be used in during the Cold War against our enemies, and all sorts of processes were used, some traumatic.
And how,
as part of it, LSD was used unbeknownst to the victims who tended to come out of prison and even the armed forces. And so there was something that maybe something in the air at this time that made this such a topic of interest widely, beyond Hubbard. So not a good historical example from the CIA and the armed forces for sure.
Curiously, Hubbard in 1951 in the book Science of Survival comments about government programs. And I sort of stop at this because the first time we really heard about this was in 1978. Walter Bowat produced a book called Operation Mind Control, and my late friend Alan Shefflin, with a co-writer called Upton, wrote The Mind Manipulators. But in 1978, this goes public. How in 1951 was Hubbard aware? Now, the first program, I think, was Operation Bluebird, and I think it's 1949. And the suggestion is because Hubbard knew Robert Heinlein, and Heinlein had top security clearance in the Navy, that he may have heard about these programs. He talks about them using pain drug hypnosis, and he talks about a method called narcosynthesis. And that confused me. I found it very hard to find any explanation of this narcosynthesis. And I finally found it in a book that Hubbard recommends called Hypnotism Comes of Age by Wolf and Rosenthal. And Hubbard, in his lecture, says everybody should read this book. Scientologists don't read this book. They don't necessarily know about it. I read it. And it describes a method of, and this is the point where the kind of therapy and mind control come together, that in the 1940s in North Africa, two brilliant psychiatrists, Grinker and Spiegel, started trying to use an abreactive method, a method where you would relive trauma. They were working with pilots and crew who'd escaped from aircraft that had been hit. And what they'd experienced, they'd often been trapped in a burning cabin. Awful things had happened to them. And simultaneously, in Britain, there was a famous psychiatrist called William Sargent, who would later write very insightful books about mind control. But in the 40s, he was doing exactly what Grinker and Spiegel were doing, but he was doing it with tank crews who'd been trapped in a burning tank or what have you. And what they sought to do was to give somebody phenobarbital, a barbiturate drug, and then get them to relive the experience, to abreact the experience. And curiously, there are references made by Hubbard which make it clear that he was aware of this. He talks about studying in the library at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital in the medical library. And at that time, he had ulcers, or he was alleged to have ulcers. They didn't find them on X-ray, but it got him out of the last year of the war, so he didn't have to do anything. And he was being treated with phenobarbital. So he was taking on a daily basis the drug that was being used, which is quite close to the truth serum or what have you. It's one of that group of things.
Yeah.
And I, by amazing good luck, there was a book called Men Under Stress, published by Grinker and Spiegel, describing their experiments. By amazing good luck, I got the second edition. If I'd got the first edition, I might not have seen the introduction they wrote to say, this method doesn't work. We really thought it was hopeful, but in fact, people just slip back afterwards. So you have this brief efflorescence, if you will, of personality that comes back, the person, and then they'll sink back into the trauma. Interesting that Hubbard appears to have taken the method, because this abreactive method, you suggest to the person they are in that place, just as a hypnotist would suggest in age regression that you've gone back somewhere, and you now go through this incident and describe it. And Hubbard's very insistent in his work that you are reliving the experience. This isn't a memory that you're playing back. You are abreacting or reliving the experience. So you have this union of ideas. Then along comes the Korean War, a month after Dianetics is published. And it's, we're already aware that there's a remarkable book written in 1955 by a Yale professor called China Under Communism, The First 5 Years. And he's one of the first, but it's coming into the West, this understanding of this thing. And the term brainwashing has taken off because Edward Hunter, who's in fact a journalist and not a member of the CIA, as is frequently said, there's nothing in the Hunter archive that suggests he'd worked for OSS, the original of the CIA, that was disbanded in 1947. So he had contacts. But Hunter introduced this word brainwashing, which is a translation of the Chinese xinao, or wash brain. What the Chinese call it, it's, you know, people get very upset about this word, but it's an original Chinese colloquialism that's actually a pun on the washing of the heart, which is a Confucian notion, because the thinking organism, according to Confucius and traditional Chinese thought, is the heart, not the mind. So you are cleansing the heart. You are getting the, and so there was a positive idea. It wasn't a negative idea, but it also comes to be called thought reform by Robert J. Lifton, or re-education. And we've seen the Chinese come back to this in Xinjiang and use these programs have always been there, and it's a part of the way the Chinese population are controlled. They leaked through North Korea into South Korea. We got the Moonies, who've exported the techniques that their founder, these techniques were used on him in a North Korean prison camp for 3 years, and he then exported them as a religious idea. And it's a very powerful group in Asia, not so much in America and Europe anymore, thankfully, because of friend Steve Hasselman.
You know, looking back on it too, some of this seemed to occur during World War II, the Holocaust, and especially Hitler.
Yes.
Hitler was injured and seemed to have a psychosomatic visual problem in World War I. Mm-hmm. Apparently his treatment was hypnosis, but a little later on in the early 30s, he seemed to be taught by somebody, a charlatan in the public sphere, how to influence people in the audience,
yes,
including large groups. And that he ended up using those techniques to influence people during these mass speeches that became so powerful, and he was so charismatic. So that was lurking in our experience also, you know, and of course had disastrous results overall.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that Hitler published a book of photographs of himself posing. And sadly, I endeavored to get a copy of this book, which was sold in vast quantities in Germany in the 1930s. And you can find kind of grainy prints from it. But he's standing there doing these things. These were rehearsed in front of the mirror in the 1920s. And he then took on a photographer who would stay with him for the rest of his life, from the 20s right through to 1945, when he killed himself, taking photographs of Hitler. There's a wonderful interview with Leni Riefenstahl, who filmed Triumph of the Will, and one of the great documentaries, even though.
Yeah.
And she said it took 6 months to cut because he kept picking his nose, or, you know, and she had to cut out all of these little bits. So it's
that wasn't intended, I gather.
No, and he was a lot less controlled than he appears. But there, you know, yes, it is that deliberate, that these are staged poses that he's learned, and the whole thing about, right, you know, raising his voice and dropping it down, and these things that he did. Still watching film of him, I don't know anybody else. You know, Tony Blair reminds me a little bit of him because of the way he uses his hands, and because he's a liar. But we won't get into that. But what was also happening, of course, behind all of this was the work that Malenkov was doing in Russia. And the Chinese, it's not necessarily well known that the Chinese Communist Party was a tiny little organization that was massively funded by Joseph Stalin. He was also funding the nationalists on the other side, so it didn't matter who won. And they had an incredible influence on the Chinese Communist Party. There were Russian observers all the time reporting back on how the money was being spent. And one of those influencers was a man who I think was called Liu, is sent to Russia, and Malenkov teaches him these processes and this approach. That is refined into the Chinese program. So it's happening there that... the CIA are desperate to find out, because the show trials in Russia, where, you know, high-ranking officials confessed to things that they couldn't possibly have done, and broke down, you know, on camera, and you can see this. So there was this thought they had these techniques and they'd learned how to do it. They hadn't. They'd actually threatened torture of the family to make people to confess. It was pretty simple.
Well, yeah, and, you know, that was one of the things that happened during the horrendous Cultural Revolution by Mao in China, how they were able to convince kids, you know, to turn on their parents and turn people in who they loved, because maybe some of it was fear, but others was their minds were just being controlled by the whole process that was put in place.
But, I mean, the Cultural Revolution, some of the acts there were really horrific. There were students killing their own parents.
Yeah.
There were professors who were being buried alive. And when people use the term brainwashing, I tend to avoid it because brainwashing in the Chinese sense is not a purely psychological process. There were a lot of physical things that were happening as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was the first procedures were in 1949. By the time the People's Republic of China is announced in October 49, 200,000 people have already been through this program, and that's the army. They've put the Red Guard, those that survived Mao's dreadful leadership, you know, the awful, awful leader. I don't know how the Long March, the Great March they did, where the vast majority of the soldiers, they were running away from the enemy, and most of them died because of the conditions. Mao was carried on a palanquin throughout. You know, it's like people's leader. But these process, then they bring in the camps, and it's not necessarily understood that there were two sets of camps. One set dealt with the landlords, as they're called, and the other sets of camp dealt with what were called the River Lake people. And there were six classes of these people, and they ranged from the Taoist wandering scholars and magicians through to prostitutes, petty thieves. There are different classifications. And what Mao taught, and because Robert J. Lifton was examining largely Catholic priests who'd been put through the first part of the program as landlords, he didn't ever, as far as I know, I think I've read everything he wrote about it, he doesn't get into the treatment of the majority, the River Lake people, which is fine. It's just that you find that they're basically being told, you have come to this situation in life because of the landlords. So there's a record of a conversation in one of the camps where a prostitute is being sullen and silent as one of the camp people is trying, one of the trainers is trying to get her to talk about what has happened. And the woman stops him and says, look, you don't understand. This is my karma. The awful things that happened to me, it's not because of the landlords, it's not because of anybody forcing me. And it was bringing class consciousness, the understanding that the evils of the world come from the bourgeoisie, come from the managing classes, and that the Chinese who were inflicting this program, and people did die during it, the Chinese who are inflicting it, when you look at the instruction, they're told to be compassionate, they're told to be kind, they're told they're doing something helpful, and they get trapped in a almost religious situation where their belief in the party is so great, their belief in Mao is so great, that by taking these processes, they will change the society. And they did change the society.
Right.
They made the most compliant society outside of North Korea that the world has ever seen, you know, where, you know, moving forward to the incredible documentary One Child Nation, where a Chinese woman went back to China 4 years after she'd left to show off her new baby and made a film. And you had women in that film who had been subjected to the one child policy, which meant that after they'd had a child, they were taken to a clinic and had a tubular ligation. And there's film of women being wrapped in sleeping bags and carried into the clinics and enforced. Even women who had had these enforced terminations, when she interviewed them, said it was a necessity. for China to go forward. So the brainwashing, the whole culture accepting these ideas becomes valuable. We then shift to America and the mind control programs. And as you say, there were a man called Sidney Gottlieb. There were, I think, 146 distinct programs. The people running them were not told that they were working for the CIA ever. There were various front groups. And the experiments that were carried out were absolutely ludicrous in many cases and just horrifically dangerous, like spraying cadmium into a crowd and seeing what happened to people afterwards. Yep. The use of a drug called BZ, which people say was 100 times stronger than LSD. I don't know how you measure that, but it does, you know, LSD, people have flashbacks, but it's a psychological thing. The drug is not stored in your body because it's water soluble. It's gone. Right. But the memories can come back. With BZ, the soldiers, largely soldiers that this was given to, would have recurrences. And they might have days where they had an acute psychosis as a consequence of this drug. It is listed in the Biological and Chemical Warfare Convention as a completely illegal substance. But of course, the guy who was the head of the World Federation of Mental Health, Ewan Cameron, in his hospitals in Canada, and the Canadian and British services were part of MKUltra too. It wasn't just the Americans. Mm-hmm. And he was erasing people's memories using isolation tanks and electroconvulsive therapy. And you've got, you know, this terrible blight on psychiatry, which is why, you know, the profession is still recovering from the terrible things that happened in the 50s, this collaboration with the desperate thought, if we don't do this, communism will take the world over.
Yeah, right.
So you have the kind of phobia that's necessary to keep that running. And Scientology is very much an offshoot of, you know, a child of that era of McCarthyist anti-communism. You know, Hubbard was deeply, you know, he was writing letters to the FBI all the time about anybody who didn't like. And he said, they're a communist, you know, there are all these letters on file. And he's playing on the fears of the time, you know, nuclear war, which, you know, is still with us, that potential, right, unfortunately. The yellow peril, the idea of a communist takeover. And he also, of course, writes what is called the Brainwashing Manual, which was fervently taken up by the John Birch Society and various other right-wing organizations and produced. And it's said to be a lecture by Beria, Lavrenti Beria, who was the head of the Cheka, the FSB, the KGB, the NKVD, whatever we call it, the security services. And it's meant to be a delivered at a university that didn't exist by Beria at a time when he was actually in prison. And I have two witnesses who were there when Hubbard dictated this. So, you know, I'm pretty sure. But it's still published. It's like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, something that's completely invented and then distributed to discredit a part of society. The frailty in it is that it mentions the Church of Scientology, and Beria was dead by the time Hubbard first registered a Church of Scientology in December 1953, let alone before February 54, when he claimed the first Church of Scientology was registered. So Beria could not have delivered this talk. But, and I've got the printing instructions for it, from Hubbard to the printer, saying, oh, let's, you know, we've got to do this many of these. Incredible, the amount of documents he left behind him in the public record. So we have this idea of brainwashing, which is that you're going to make somebody compliant to your will.
Right.
I would say that what happened was that in Scientology, it became exactly the thing it was criticizing, that Conway and Siegelman, who would become well known for the book Snapping, their examination of Jonestown, their ideas of information disease, they said, having examined members of all sorts of groups, that Scientology had the most debilitating set of rituals of any cult in America. And it's where you get this reversal that what is creates a community. It makes you feel part of something. It makes you have a motivation in the world. You're going to make the world a better place. You know, you're going to clear the planet, as Scientologists say. And if you have to break a few legs along the way, you know, if you have to do a little bit of harm, then it's all for the good in the end. And if to achieve your self-determinism, which is the stated goal from the beginning of Dianetics and Scientology, you will become in charge of yourself. You can now go and join the SEA organization, SEA, a body of water, L. Ron Hubbard's personal organization, and you sign a contract for 1,000 million years, because they believe in reincarnation, yeah, and you promise to follow and uphold command intention during that 1,000 million years, at the end of which you'll probably get your self-determinism back. But it's this crazy world where things reverse, where we're going to have to trap you so that you can have liberty. You know, you're going to have to behave in a, last night I watched a 1940s British film called The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, with Roger Livesey, which is a wonderful production. And it's based on the idea that the British people, being noble by nature, would never do the dirty underhanded things that the Germans are doing. And the argument is, we have to do those things or they'll beat us. And that argument winds its way insidiously into Guantanamo Bay and also, you know, the British torture in Northern Ireland, of supposed IRA people. You know, that these, the means and the ends become confused and people start thinking you can do something immoral. And that by believing, you know, you'll be thoroughly self-determined at the point where you agree completely with Ron Hubbard's description of the world. Right. And that jarred with me eventually, and then it all evaporated.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, to speak of my own field, psychiatry, I think it was quite positive that Freud then turned away from hypnosis to a completely different technique, really, called free associations, which supports talking about anything that comes to mind. So when you're talking about freedom of thinking, he set the groundwork for that. Now, it's debatable how successful psychoanalysis has been as a treatment, but I'm certainly pleased it went in that direction. And it was part of my training in the early 70s. And there were some remnants even of a couple of things you mentioned by the early 70s. One is sodium amytal, the truth serum you mentioned. So yeah. I was trained.
And sodium pentothal is the other one. Yeah.
Sort of trying to remember. The goal was to find out something that we thought the patient knew about, but wouldn't tell us. Well, it didn't work. And so that was that as far as I was concerned. And then we were supposed to learn hypnosis. As it turned out, I couldn't be hypnotized. So that made me doubt the usefulness of it also. But hypnosis has continued, but with lots of controversy still. It's still unclear and debatable how much it helps people. It seems maybe to help by ethical clinicians who will use it to reduce certain destructive habits like smoking. But it's also used in parlor games and people can easily be taken advantage. And so it's really not a mainstream treatment at all in psychiatry, but it's kind of on the fringes. And it can be positive or negative depending on who's using it for what. But as far as a psychotherapy, it doesn't really seem to fit that as any kind of a standard usage. So,
an essential part of hypnotism, I was pleased by the Oxford Handbook on hypnotism, which says, it gives the definition that hypnotism is guided imagination. And when we move aside from, you know, the famous Svengali swinging his watch for Trilby, which is what we would call deep trance. And And I have terrible trouble with these words. I think they lead us down a garden path. When people talk about altered states of being, I'm saying, can we call them different states? Because what are we altering from? What's meant to be the normal, consistent state of being? We have different moods. Sometimes we're happy, sometimes we're sad. When we're happy, we see the world through rose-tinted spectacles. When we're sad, we can't see the world at all for all the grime on our glasses. Yeah. But we also, you know, there are psychiatric conditions as well, like bipolar disorder and what have you, which have the extremes of that, that some people will experience. But I would say that we all of us have a certain hypnotic ability, so that if you are able to sit and read a novel and become completely immersed in the novel, or if when you, my mum said that she went with her mum and dad to see a film in about, I don't know, 1925 or something, about the death of Queen Victoria. And she said that she and her dad were both crying at the end of the film, you know, and her mum was saying, yeah, people die, you know, it's get over it. That she wasn't drawn into this attempt to, you know, patriotically inflame her. But if we are creative people, tend to be more easy to hypnotize. And this is to do with the imagination. It's to do with being able to get somebody. So when somebody does one of those visualization exercises and says, imagine yourself popping the ball through the hoop, or imagine yourself on a lovely desert island where there's an ASMR voice telling you, you know, that this has become so normalized that people don't think of it as hypnotism. But if you change somebody's state, you know, you move them into a different state of consciousness, then some sort of process has taken place. We are still mystified. There are brain experiments that show that a hypnosis, the state of trance, is different in the brain. It's that simple. There's something else going on, but we've been confused from the start. The word hypnos, meaning sleep, being the first part of the confusion, because it's not a state of sleep. But there seem to be different ways. As you say, some therapists, and Milton Erickson shines out, of course, were able to do remarkable things by moving people's state of mind. And I'm baffled by Erickson. I read, there's a book of his little stories, and it tells you what was wrong with the person, what story he told them, and that they were better afterwards. And I do know about this stuff. I am not a practitioner of hypnotism, but I've studied it in some depth. And I often, with the stories, it's, you know, I can understand Zen stories. They make sense to me. But Erickson tells them about breakfast cereal and they no longer get headaches. You know, there's a sensitivity in him that I don't think you can train. I think it's the fact that he had polio as a child and, you know, became super observant of other human beings, so he could do something. And the problem is, I think the problem is twofold. I think it's necessary to recognize that these processes do occur in people. And if they do occur, we need to be aware of them. So in a therapeutic situation, if somebody might be too suggestible and they might start taking on, you know, there might be transference involved in Freud's terms, they might start trying to please us. They might, you know, with the therapist or indeed with anyone, they might start fitting in with that way of being. So, if for me, the aim of any therapeutic conversation would be to give control to the individual. And all too often, the opposite happens and people pick up a way of being. So with Scientology, you have a set of rules that you now have to follow, and which includes pretending certain emotional states, you know, pretending to be happy, which is something we see in a lot of groups, I'm afraid. And accepting the dogma of the leader rather than having a dogma that says, well, we talked about this before, Peshar, the idea in Jewish tradition that the Bible is there, Torah is there to be discussed. It's there, you're there to see how it applies to your life rather than say, and it doesn't even matter whether Daniel, you know, was in a lion's den. What matters is, what does this mean to my life? And fundamentalists push away all of the metaphor, all of the interpretation, and become literalist, you know.
Yeah, even more than what does it mean to your life, which is really important, is there's a positive view of arguing the principles, other than, again, very orthodox side, but you're supposed to argue the principles. And so that says by itself, nobody knows really the right way to interpret this stuff. And we learn from each other, and that in its own way frees our minds. So I think that a pretty unique aspect of Judaism, again, at least in its non-very orthodox way. And for the Torah, we come back every year and study the same passages over and over, because the idea is we've also changed as a year. And so the passages may mean something different to us this year than it did for me last year. And next year, it'll also be different. So I think all that enhances the freedom of mind. I would say that a priori, a freedom of mind isn't an all good. You know, you could have freedom of mind and bad morals, and, you know, and so it's not necessarily always a positive thing, but more often I think it has positive things in terms of self-actualization and compassion for other people and so on. So,
yeah, I absolutely agree. It's rather like the way that mindfulness has been pulled out of the eight noble truths, and they're Jon Kabat-Zinn and Daniel Goleman are saying you don't need the other seven. And the same with freedom of mind. It's one aspect. But if we are immoral, as you say, then our freedom becomes, you know, liberty for wolves is death for sheep, as Isaiah Berlin so succinctly put it. And we find ourselves preyed upon. And that's something with religion that has so often been the case, that religion has become the tool of manipulators and a way of, you know, suppressing freedom of thought, free thinking, as it used to be called before it was called atheism, and prohibiting development. One of the fascinations for me of, say, the translation period in Islam in the 9th century onwards, this idea that they wanted to collect all of the knowledge of the world together. They wanted to collect all of the science of the world together. And of course, this comes on the heels of the iconoclast movement in Christianity, which had destroyed the library at Alexandria, you know, which had destroyed, you know, we've just back from a wonderful tour to Turkey, where we largely stayed in Istanbul, and looking at the destruction that was visited by the iconoclasts, all of the mosaics that were ripped out, all of, you know, this awful thing. Based upon a religious fervor that said, and I can understand that idea, you know, when I sort of, as a child, saw the God creating Adam that's in the Sistine Chapel, I kind of went, isn't that blasphemous? You know, this is, we're not meant to have graven images of God, and yet this is Michelangelo doing this great big beardy bloke. So I can understand what drives it, what Robert J. Lifton called the demand for purity. You know, and we start finding ourselves in a place where, for me, if we are not humanist, if we don't center everything on the well-being of our species, which includes the well-being of other species, with the exception of the tsetse fly and the mosquito and a few other things we could do without. I don't care where they are in the food chain. I want to be rid of them. But if we center everything on the good of human beings rather than the good of people of a particular religion or the good of people of a certain skin color or a certain economic position, if we're always focused on that, then no matter what somebody's religion or belief system is, it's probably going to be okay. And the problem is where there becomes an us and them, another, they're deviant, we're the elect, you know, that kind of attitude, which is so easy for human beings to adopt.
Yeah, it's sort of a natural process. I think we're kind of born with this tendency to fear the other who's different, and because that feels dangerous. And so it's not always easy to overcome. I think all of us need at least two identities. One, our main cultural and ethnic identity, although that can easily have more than one. But I think we need a global identity, and those two have to overlap. You know, we're part of the whole species, as you mentioned, and we have our unique aspects, and those have to intertwine and overlap. What you bring up also makes me think a lot about the kind of clinical principles I used when I was seeing patients, because I think without knowing it, I was trying to deal with the negative stuff of we're talking about, because psychiatrists could obviously influence patients in what we say. All physicians can, you know. And my rule of thumb was, number one, ask the patients what they think is wrong and go from there. And secondly, ask them what they think is going to help and go from there. And so over time, what I added on is the question, what gives your life the most meaning? And we'll gear the treatment to that. And so I tried to put as much as I could in the patient's hand in a way to educate me. And then, you know, our hopefully therapeutic alliance would result in their also listening to me and then coming to their own conclusions. And, you know, the only time I wouldn't go along with them, essentially, even if I thought there was a better way to do things, is if I thought they were in danger to themselves or others. Otherwise, I wanted them to be in control of their treatment and what they thought about themselves, essentially.
Yeah, and I think that that's worth underlining. What gives your life the most meaning? And it's something even in relatively casual conversation that people, you know, strangers on a train. I don't mean the Hitchcock movie. when you meet somebody and they'll sometimes just or on a plane, they'll completely open up to you. You'll find yourself in a situation which, whether you like it or not, is potentially therapeutic for them because it's safe for them to talk. And I do find that my conversation starters with people are things like, what are you really interested in? Mm. You know, what gives me, as you say, meaning to your life? What brings you joy? And tell me about that, because by hearing that, I will inevitably find something out about the world. You know, it amazes me that we recommend all sorts of things to our friends. We recommend music and books. And we live in a culture that runs at such high speed now. I don't think it's always been this way, that those recommendations tend to be pushed aside because we're looking at the next thing on our feed. And I found it very useful to find out from people what books they read, what movies, what music, because it opens up the world to me and brings new things to me.
Exactly. You know, and it seems like the internet is set up differently, you know, with the process of likes being so prominent. Mm-hmm. You know, when I want to learn or experience additional music, I don't want suggestions to be what I already like. Yeah. I want suggestions that are different, and I may not like the different music, but I don't know unless I experience it. And so how do we open up our minds by viewing the same sort of stuff over and over again? That ends up sort of having cultish aspects to it, because you don't open yourself up to others' ways of thinking and feeling and experiencing. So the internet, I think, has been a gigantic problem in what we're talking about, as people get locked into certain ways of viewing things and getting influenced by likes. And I mean, I don't really care if somebody else likes what I've written, you know, as long as they're not going to do anything to harm me. So.
Yes. And by the way, anybody watching, please don't do anything to harm Steve. That's not allowed. And it's something of the, you know, the xenophobia, the fear of strangers and the fear of strangeness, that our willingness to look at other cultures and what becomes cultural. We have this idea at the moment of cultural appropriation, which I absolutely love, because it means, for example, that the Indians shouldn't be using chilies in their food because they came from Mexico. And when we look at the arts, what aspect of the arts is not the joy of meeting some other form? So the way that, for example, ukiyo-e woodblock prints influenced the Impressionists.
Yeah, it's cultural appreciation, not appropriation.
Yeah, you're not, as long as you're not trying to take it away from them. And we go the other way, which is the kind of tourist traps, the poor Lakota performing the Sundance to an audience. And you're kind of going, I think we've lost a certain amount of value there. But I was in South Africa years ago, and the woman who was looking after me, driving me around, said it was a terrible thing that the tribal peoples were losing their culture. And I'd never thought about it in such direct terms. But the idea popped into my head. We have what's called Morris dancing in this country, where people dress up in these white and green outfits and have little bells and staffs and jingle around. And it just made me think, oh, have we got to force these people to keep doing whatever? You know, where is the boundary between coca colonization and, you know, the destruction of traditional forms? And also, to what extent are there any traditional forms? You know, that seeing, you know, you mention Orthodox Jews, so the Haredi, the Lubavitch, whatever, and seeing the little curls of hair and the hats and all this, this is not the way Abraham dressed. You know, this is 17th, 18th century dress, just like the Amish, to maintain a tradition. And looking at, say, the Christian church, again, having just been to Nicaea, Iznik, where the first Christian council was held in 325 AD by the Emperor Constantine, who had moved the center of the Roman Empire to what he would call modestly Constantinople. And you have this ridiculous situation where this Roman emperor is dictating terms to these bishops, telling them what they've got to do, where they've got to go. And this becomes a formula, the Nicene Creed: I believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth, so on and so forth, which is believed by Catholics, Orthodox Christians, and Protestants. There are very few sects outside of it. Those rules were enforced by Constantine. He said, if you don't finish soon, I'm going to have you all executed, you know, in a good, loving, religious manner, obviously. Of course, you know, he didn't mean any real harm. And seeing the way that they would have believed, compared to me going into a church now, they wouldn't recognize any of what we do now, because we do, whether we evolve is another matter, but we do change, we do grow, and the culture moves around. So even our church music is based in Jewish music and Roman music that came together and gave us Gregorian chant and then onto polyphony and all of this stuff. But you can hear those themes when you hear a cantor in a synagogue. You can go, oh, I recognize that way of approaching the words, you know, this way of saying this is sacred, this is important, you should be listening to this, you know.
And sometimes Christian music is brought into Judaism, including the use of the organ became a large part of Jewish music. So nothing wrong with that at all. You know, it's trying to use hopefully the best of different cultures. That's all.
And understanding what you said earlier, that we consider ourselves as part of our own ethnicity, our own cultural group, and that's not a bad thing, as long as our own cultural group isn't vicious and horrific. But we are also part of all of humanity. And by, you know, accepting, I as you know, I've had this crazy thing about Gustav Mahler, and I've just become completely immersed in his work, which happens to me from time to time. And one of the things that came up was a statement made by Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney said, when the Beatles were coming together, John Lennon and I used to sit down and sing the Kindertoten, try and play and sing the Kindertotenlieder by Mahler. Now, there's an influence I hadn't expected, really, you know, that Sergeant Pepper comes out of Mahler, as well as George Martin and what have you. But to say these influence, and of course, George Harrison, deeply influenced by Indian music, and particularly Ravi Shankar, and I think did some very interesting things with that, you know, Within You, Without You, and it is a very interesting construction, because it doesn't fit the Indian form and it doesn't fit the Western form. It's how he perceived Indian music in that early point of his study of it. And it gives us something new and original and quite exciting.
Yeah.
So,
when we've talked about this before in music, we both love jazz, and jazz is so terrific at bringing people of different cultures together. We just saw last night or the night before the Vijay Iyer's trio. So Vijay is Indian American from India, and his father came over, and he's actually a professor at Harvard also. And then he's a pianist, and his bass player was Hispanic, and the drummer was Black. And that you could see all of them, bits of their traditions coming through the music, but they ended up putting it all together in a unique, positive way. And I actually wrote my column today on how Iyer's emphasizes compassion. He talked about that right at the beginning, because his newest album is called Compassion. And that's what he was trying to get across with the music they played. And I think they did it, although it's always hard to translate abstract music into some sort of meaning.
Yeah.
But the beauty of jazz, almost right from its beginning, with Blacks and whites joining together, has been multicultural and shows the best that humans can do in learning from each other and getting something positive out of it. So it's so important to do that in different ways. You can do that through literature, of course, and you mentioned art and so on, but it's really important to see how this kind of exposure and interaction can work instead of causing conflicts like I think we're having nowadays because of the war in the Middle East. I don't know if I mentioned to you before, but because of the conflict between Muslims and Jews in the Middle East now, the alliances, the interfaith alliances between Jews and Muslims, as well as psychiatrists from other religions, is tending to dissipate and break down. And to me, of all professions, we should be continuing to work together, because the only way good is going to come out of this is if our different backgrounds, whether it's in countries or in professions, can work together, not split apart and dislike each other just because I'm a Jewish psychiatrist and he's a Muslim psychiatrist or a Christian psychiatrist. So it's a distressing time in that sort of way.
Absolutely. I mean, I probably got myself into trouble last year because my friend, Professor Alexander Dvorkin, who is a professor of medieval history in Moscow, was expelled, I think along with two other Russians, from FECRIS, which is the Europe-wide umbrella group funded by the European Council to, you know, let people know about authoritarian cults. And I mean, I've known Sasha since 1993, I think. He has been a tireless worker. He has never accepted payment for what he does. So he works 3 days a week as a professor teaching or something like. And then he has traveled throughout, particularly Eastern Europe and the Orthodox community, giving free talks, helping people who've been caught up, standing up against people like Vissarion or the Om Shinrikyo. And it appeared to me that what happened was that FECRIS decided that because he's Russian, he's anti-Ukrainian, and therefore he can't. And he was helping to run FECRIS for years and years and years. And suddenly he's thrown into the outer darkness at a point where it becomes necessary to communicate more, to, you know, rather than closing the doors, to actually say, you know, how can we solve this problem? And to understand that he's in a situation where if he stands up and says, okay, this thing in Ukraine shouldn't be happening, they'll send him to prison and no benefit will have been achieved. So, yes, these peculiar situations where we have to redouble our efforts to be compassionate and to treat other human beings as human beings rather than as some kind of vermin or, you know, some disreputable horror. And what's happening in Gaza and now in Syria and in Iran and doubtless in Iraq, it's just it's impossible to comprehend from the outside, isn't it? You're going, well, why are you doing this? Why are you killing people? What were you thinking? What do you think is going to happen as a consequence of this? It seems like an infantile idea that you can completely destroy an opponent. And if you don't, and they have children, you know, I think part of what we're experiencing in the West now from China, people are really unaware of what the European countries and later on America did to China in Shanghai, in Macau, in Hong Kong, at the opium wars, where opium was being exported into China, grown by Clive of India in Bengal, and forced on the Chinese. And they twice fought wars to try and stop it. So there is a certain amount of resentment in China against the Round Eyes and what was done.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, compassion is so important. But you can even have too much. I think part of compassion is sort of what you do with it, you know, and so can you use it to help situations out that need to be helped. It's a little like empathy in that regard. Empathy is a great quality to have, to understand people and put yourself in other people's shoes. But then what do you do with that knowledge once you have it? Again, it could be used for good or not. And so, in the Middle East, you would think obviously there's better solutions than what's going on right now, but politicians seem to be caught up with a certain way of reacting to things, which is just getting worse and worse for the time being. So,
yeah, there's a line in a song, "The leaders of the free world are just little boys throwing stones." It's a song by the wonderful band Elbow from Manchester. And I don't actually recommend this book on the grounds that it doesn't really tell you much beyond the title. And if you've got the idea, but what he's saying is that it's called Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. And I think we've talked about this before as well, but I came to realize some time ago that I have what I call the empathy disorder. It's not rational. It's not helpful to me. I've put myself in situations where I was concerned about others and have sacrificed myself. And that is the Christian way. But I'm not a Christian, so why am I doing this? You know, realizing I've been taken advantage of by all sorts of sociopaths and narcissists and Machiavellians over the years, and that's okay. I'm not too badly damaged from it because I didn't have any money to give them, so that was all fine. You know? But this idea of rational compassion, as you say, there are limits to freedom of mind, that our compassion needs to be rational. We need to be looking forward. I complained, I think, the last time we talked about Nasir Gaymi and his book, A First Rate Madness, where he suggests that in times of crisis, the best leaders are mad people. It's like, okay, that's fine. And he gives us his first example of eight, William Tecumseh Sherman, and he calls him a great leader. And I'm going, have I mistaken history at this point? And this guy has a degree in history as well as being a professor of psychiatry. Because as I understand it, Sherman burning the South, Atlanta and Savannah, is what caused the current North-South divide. You know, it's never recovered from what happened there. And he makes no mention of what Sherman did after the Civil War, which was, of course, he headed the Bureau of Indian Affairs and ran the genocide against the Plains people. And if that's great leadership, but he credits him with an invention, and I don't think he was, in fact, the first to wage total war. I think that the Romans had done it in Carthage, where they burned everything and salted the ground and then went, where are we going to get our bread from? I mean, how we've destroyed this country that used to feed us. But this idea of total war, of annihilating the enemy, it happened in Korea, the shame of Korea, that thousands of refugees trying to flee North Korea were shot dead under military instruction. It happened in Vietnam. It's happened more recently in Syria, the Russian campaign in Syria. This idea of if you just destroy everything, but if you leave somebody alive, then in the next generation or maybe another generation, that division that you've created in humanity will come back and bite you in the ass. You know, yeah. So these, we have to live together somehow or other. We have to learn to cooperate. And I think we have to change the power structure in our society. I'm absolutely not a communist. I'm absolutely not a socialist, whether in Bismarck's idea of socialism, which is, I think actually I'm a socialist in that sense, which is everybody gets to eat, everybody has somewhere to live. But I'm not left wing at all, but I'm also not right wing. And so seeing that I think we should have a democracy rather than the plutocracy, the rule of the corporations and Elon Musk and these people who can tell governments what to do. You know, Elon Musk touring the world and going to see Erdogan in Turkey and Netanyahu in Israel. And this isn't right, that we should have a different class of politicians, yeah. Not authoritarians, but people who are actually concerned about our welfare, you know, and don't think that murder is the right way to rule the world.
Yeah, yeah. And democracy probably is the best way to get there, but there too, in the United States, we have so much divisiveness and conflict because there's not enough sharing and compassion and empathy of bringing people together. So it's probably got the most potential, but it waxes and wanes in how, you know, well that's being done. And as you said, the leadership is crucial. And you would think President Biden, who has a lot of obvious compassion for people, in part because of what he lost during his lifetime, but he hasn't been able to make that work well enough yet. So, yeah, I definitely would agree with your goal, but it's tough. And again, I think the internet is, as it exists now, is a big obstacle. And then, you know, with artificial intelligence coming, how that's going to influence how people think and do things is another important variable.
Absolutely. We have echo chambers and we have rabbit holes,
yeah.
and people separating themselves out into warring factions rather than looking at ways in which we can agree and go forward.
Yes.
Well, there we are. fascinating. Thank you so much, Stephen. We will we'll get together again soon, I hope. And by that time, what's this incredible award you're being given in May by the American Psychiatric Association? Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned humanitarian stuff somewhere while we were talking. So this award is called the Abraham Halpern Humanitarian Award. And it's the 12th one that's given out. The first one was actually to Robert J. Lifton, who was a role model and mentor for me. And so I actually have a little trouble with the word humanitarian, because it tends to refer to humans. But you qualified that really well, because humans have to also try to take care of non-humans and the earth and plants and so on. So if humanitarian includes that provision, I'm all for it. But, so I have to give a lecture to get this award. You always pay for good things, I think. But,
yeah,
I have to give a lecture, and the working title is something like The Impossible Dream. And it's talking about how social psychiatry can try to integrate religion, humanism, and psychiatry together. And I want to start out with my wife singing an excerpt from The Impossible Dream for Man of La Mancha. Don Quixote in the play ends up being delusional. And I hope I don't sound delusional as I talk about this goal of reducing what I've started to call social psychopathologies, meaning racism, sexism, ageism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, blah, 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 because I think those are causing immense problems for humanity, and we haven't made much progress. And maybe medicalizing them in some way will add some innovative ideas to how to address them. So we'll see.
And it's been an interesting interface, the interface between philosophy and psychiatry. That, you know, for example, and I won't labor the point, but there's a wonderful book written by a German philosopher about psychopathy and taking the views of, well, what is evil and how do we look at this? And I found it, you know, we are being simplistic in our view. Let's just put it that way, I feel.
Yeah, well, let me just mention one psychiatrist, since you mentioned philosophy and its connection to psychiatry, perhaps. So my word is coming out of the American Association for Social Psychiatry, and I was president around the new millennium. Anyways, there's also a World Association for Social Psychiatry, and the head of that now is a psychiatrist named Vincenzo Di Nicola. And he tries to integrate philosophy, which he was trained in, with psychiatry. And he now does a regular column for Psychiatric News from that perspective, and has written lots of books. He has a slow thinking manifesto, and he's definitely worth looking into for anybody who's interested in how philosophy and religion can be combined.
Yeah, absolutely. Good tip. Grand. Well, thank you very much. And I hope, you know, your speech goes well, because we won't meet before then. And I look forward to seeing you in a month or two's time.
Sounds good.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Appreciate the talk and discussion, and whoever been watching. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Take care.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.